Ecclesiastes chapter 3, and just reading the first 14 verses. So Solomon says, there is a time for everything, and a season for every activity under the heavens. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to tear down and a time to build. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to scatter stones and a time to gather them. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to search and a time to give up. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear and a time to mend. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. What do workers gain from their toil? I have seen the burden God has laid on the human race. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the human heart. Yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. I know that there is nothing better for people than to be happy and to do good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil. This is the gift of God. I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does it so that people will fear him. Well, this week I was working on a leaflet outlining some of the activities that we as a church offer the community, which at the end of the month is going to be displayed at Lapworth Clinic's flu clinic to inform the 250 locals. That seems like a lot of people to have to one flu clinic, but there's going to be 250 locals going to Lapworth surgery to this flu clinic. And they wanted to have literature basically to tell these people what is going on in the village, some of the groups and various activities that they can avail themselves of. And they wanted us to contribute some literature to that. And so that's what I was spending some of my week doing. And being a perfectionist and aware that whatever I produce would be seen by the public, I really invested, I guess you could say, an inordinate amount of time into making this leaflet as polished and as perfect as possible. Now, for those of you who are familiar with my track record of technological misfortune and the mishaps that I've had to face with vanishing documents and sermons and the like, you may be able to guess what did, or rather what didn't happen when I went to reopen this document, having just made a slight change to it and saved it just moments before. Wonder if you can guess what happened. Well, it didn't open, and there on my computer came this dialogue box that said, "Publisher has detected a problem in the file you are trying to open." And so this thing, this document, this leaflet that I had spent so long working on, which seconds earlier had opened perfectly fine without even a scent or a sniff of setback and mishap, it was now, apart from an earlier version that I'd saved under another name, it was gone. And so began the frustrating process, the futile process, really, of trying to recover this document, going online and going on to all of these forums. How do you recover a publisher document that's been corrupted? And I went through all of the steps and the stages that they recommended, but none of it was working. And so began the painstaking process of trying to put back together this document that I had previously, until it got to a point where I thought, yes, it's now complete. It now looks like what it used to look like. Now this morning I wonder, as I did this week, if you've ever asked yourself who is really in control? I wonder if you've ever thought that to yourself. Who's really in charge? Because, and not just when it comes to technology, but when it comes to life in general, have you thought to yourself, who is really calling the shots here? Because often, just like with technology and all of these other things that go wrong in our lives, we feel out of control, don't we? We feel that life is dictating to us rather than us dictating to life. We feel maybe that life is a bit of an event and we're just stood there watching it happen and we're powerless to do anything about it. Maybe the house gets burgled, and actually while we were away, just on our road, up the road, some people were burgled on three consecutive nights. Maybe someone crashes into the side of your car. All of these things happen and we ask ourselves, who's really in control? Because it sure doesn't feel like it's us. Well, this morning, that's the question I want us to think about as we come to this passage, as we come to Ecclesiastes chapter 3. This question of who's really in control? Who really is in charge? If, as Shakespeare said, all the world's a stage, then the question is, who's the playwright? Who is writing the script of life? And to begin, really, by answering that question negatively, we see that Solomon in this passage says that we are not the ones who are in control. I hate to break it to you this morning, but in this fallen world, in this broken world, we are, I am, you are not in control. We're not. Just look there at verse 1. It says, there is a time for everything and a season for every activity under the heavens. In other words, there is a set time for everything that happens in life. There is a specific season for all that goes on in this world. Times and seasons that we have no ultimate control over. So just take verse 2 as a prime example. It says there that there is a time to be born and a time to die. Now, who here this morning could possibly say that they had any control over their birth? It would be something, wouldn't it, if you were able to control your parents before you were even born. We know that we don't have any say about when we're going to be born. And what about death? Sure, well, people try and take their lives into their own hands by deciding when they're going to end them. But ultimately, they can't control the fact that they are going to die. Because when it comes to death, we are utterly powerless to stop it. The end of our lives, as well as the beginning of our lives, those things are completely out of our control. But it's not just the bookends of our lives that Solomon says are out of our control. Everything, he says, is out of our control. All of the activities, all of the highs, all of the lows that we experience in this world, they have a time. And that time is not determined by us. So take work, for instance. Solomon, in that passage, that bit where there's all of these times for various different things, he says there is a time to plant and a time to uproot. Now we know we've got harvest coming in a couple of weeks' time. And as we think about the farmers, we know that they can't sow their seed whenever they feel like it. You know, people of today are a bit postmodern in their approach to things in life, aren't they? And they say, I'll do that when the time feels right. Imagine if the farmer said that. Imagine if they said, I'll sow my seed when it feels right for me. No, they can't do that. They are governed by the seasons. There is a definite time when they must plant, and there is a definite time when they must uproot. And that's true for our work, if we're still in work today, isn't it? Is governed by factors that are external to us. Stock markets and trends and customers and deadlines and economic climates. And we could go on all of these things that are outside of our control. The point is, what we do in some way or another is shaped and governed and controlled by powers outside of ourselves. And we take our experiences as another example. Solomon says there is a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance. Now, even the toddler who has just grazed his knee is aware of that truth. One minute he's laughing at something ridiculous on the TV, and then the next he's bawling his eyes out on his mother's lap. He realizes that, in a sense, the time for him to laugh and the time for him to cry is not controlled by factors that he is in control of. And in this fallen world, we know only too well, don't we, the painful reality of this dualism. Sometimes, and I don't know if you can testify to this morning, sometimes it feels that life is one big coin with smiles on one side and tears on the other. And some days it feels like it lands facing up, and other days it feels like it lands facing down. And sadly, try as we might, there is nothing we can do to determine what side it will fall on, either tears or smiles. And so Solomon looks at the whole kaleidoscope of human existence and says, we're not in control. There is a time for everything, yes, but it's not up to us to decide when that time is. So we kill and we retaliate when our nation is attacked. We heal when our soldiers are wounded. We tear down when a building is derelict. We build a new one in its place. We search when we've lost something and give up when hope is exhausted. We're silent when we need to listen and speak when we need to be heard. In this fallen world, we are not in control. life is not under our tyranny, but in a sense we are under life's. I wonder this morning if you've ever come to that realization. I wonder whether you've ever discovered, actually, I'm not in control of my life. I remember a couple of years ago, and this ties in with my prolonged history with technological mishaps, I was preparing a sermon with a similar point to this one. The sermon was on Jonah's descent to the bottom of the sea and how powerless he was in that situation. And as I was typing up that sermon the day before I was supposed to be preaching it, my computer crashed. That was it. That was the end of the computer. It just died on me. And so my sermon, which ironically was all about being powerless, it was gone. It was gone forever. And in that moment, I did feel powerless. There was absolutely nothing I could do to bring that sermon back. I was totally and utterly incapable of changing that situation. And in moments like those, you come to terms with the fact, I'm not in control. I'm not the master of my universe. There are things that happen in this life that I have no power over whatsoever. I wonder what swung it for you this morning. I wonder what made you say, hang on a minute, I'm not in charge here. I'm not the one running this show. Maybe tragically, painfully, it was that phone call to say a close relative had just been given the diagnosis that they had been dreading, receiving. Maybe it was that meeting to let you know that you were being made redundant. Maybe it was that letter to inform you, the bailiffs, they're going to be round in 2 weeks' time to take your stuff. All of those things happen and you realize, no, I'm not in control. I'm not the one who is in charge of my life. And it's not just the bad stuff that reminds us of that, is it? It's not just the bad stuff that reminds us we're not in control. The good things that happen to us also serve to show us how contingent we are on the circumstances of life. So the joy that a new baby brings, or maybe the delight of finding a life partner, or the pleasure of a meal with friends, in a sense, these things, these joys, these highs, are dependent on factors that we have no control over. Ultimately, we can't dictate the ups just as much as we can't stop the downs. And so Solomon says life is a series of ebbs and flows, of successes and failures, of mountains and valleys over which you have no control. And isn't it so true that when the good times come, we just want to bottle them up. We want to just save them for a rainy day, but we know that we can't do that. We know that we don't have any power, that kind of power. Instead, I guess the imagery of what life is often like trying to build a sandcastle when the tide is coming in. Have you ever done that with your children? Or maybe when you were growing up, you loved building sandcastles, but you were doing it as the tide was coming in. And so in life, we plan and we build and we craft our lives until they look like a work of art. But then what happens? The waves of adversity or loss or bereavement come and they knock down this life that we have been building for ourselves. And we've got no choice but to start building it all over again. But then that begs the question, doesn't it? If we're not the ones who are in control, and I'm sure we would all say that that is so absolutely true this morning, we're not the ones who are in charge. If that is true, if we're not the ones who are steering the rudder of life, who exactly is it that sets the times and appoints the seasons in which the array of human life occurs? I think verse 14 gives us the answer. What does Solomon say there? He says, I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. In other words, what God does, there is a permanency to it. There's a certainty to it. When he makes a decision, when he acts in a certain way, it lasts and it endures. What he does is fixed. His work is permanent. As Solomon says, nothing can be added to it and nothing can be taken from it. When God does something, that's it. It's solid, it's fixed, it's secure. And so try as we might, we cannot change what God does. We cannot stop him from exercising his sovereign rule in our lives. He is the one who is in charge. He is the one who is in control. And this is a theme that runs right through Ecclesiastes. This theme that God is the sovereign creator who oversees all the affairs of human life. So maybe you can flick with me to chapter 5 and verse 2. Chapter 5 and verse 2. And here Solomon is speaking about how we approach God. And he says, do not be quick with your mouth. Do not be hasty in your heart to utter anything before God. God is in heaven and you are on earth, so let your words be few. In other words, when you come to God, remember who you're speaking to. Remember who you're coming to. You're coming to God. You're speaking to the one who is the King there in heaven above every other power, every other prince, every other principality. He is the sovereign God. That's who you're coming to. He is the one who is in control. Then look at chapter 5 and verse 18. Solomon says, "This is what I have observed to be good, that it is appropriate for a person to eat, to drink, and to find satisfaction in their toilsome labor under the sun during the few days of life God has given them. For this is their lot." Where does life come from? Who is the one who gives us life according to that verse? Well, it's God, isn't it? God is the one who gives life, and so by implication, He is the one who takes it away. Our lives are completely, fully in His hands. Sometimes we think we're the captain or the master or the prime minister or the president of our lives. Actually, no, God is the one. He is the one who is sovereign. He is the one who is in charge of all things. And finally, chapter 7, verse 13. Again, you can turn there with me. Chapter 7, verse 13. And Solomon says this, he says, "Consider what God has done. Who can straighten what He has made crooked? When times are good, be happy. But when times are bad, consider this, God has made the one as well as the other. Therefore, no one can discover anything about their future." Every time, every season, whether good or bad, is ultimately in some mysterious way, either directly or indirectly, it's set by God. What it says there in that passage, doesn't it, that He has made the one as well as the other, the good times and the bad times, the ups as well as the downs. And so consequently, although we would desperately like to, we can never be sure what's around the corner, can we? Because that is the prerogative of God. Our futures are His domain. He is the one who oversees what is happening in our lives. Now this morning, I wonder how that makes you feel. Wonder how it makes you feel to know God is sovereign, to know that He is in control. Maybe it comforts you this morning. Maybe it comforts you as a Christian to know that He is the one who is orchestrating the ups and downs of life. That if you belong to Him, nothing happens to you. Nothing that happens to you takes Him by surprise because it all falls squarely within His plan. Is that how you feel about God being in control? Wow, what a comfort. What a joy it is to know that I am safe in the hands of God. Or maybe this morning, maybe it grates you. Maybe it grates you and annoys you maybe a little bit that you're not the one who is in control, but that God is. Maybe it even angers you that God would dare meddle in the affairs of your life and that He determines when your good times are going to be and He determines when your bad times are going to be. Maybe that's how it makes you feel this morning. Frustrated. Maybe it ruffles your feathers. Well, as we consider this passage, actually, and if you feel frustrated with the sovereignty of God, Solomon admits that his sovereignty can be frustrating. This fact that God is in control and not us, it can lead to exasperation. I don't know if you ever had with your children and you would take them here and there and you would make them visit this place and that place and you would ask them to complete this task and that chore. And they would just get exasperated, wouldn't they? They just wanted to do their own thing. They wanted to go where they wanted to do. They wanted to do what they wanted to do. And maybe that's how we feel. Under the sovereignty of God, I just want to do my thing. I want life to go my way. And so sometimes we can feel annoyed that we're not the ones running our lives. And Solomon says that that is the case. Look there at verse 9. He says, "What do workers gain from their toil?" Now, on the surface, that verse seems a bit out of place, doesn't it? So Solomon, he just spent the last 8 verses talking about the full spectrum of human life and experience. And yet, here in verse 9, he decides to hone in exclusively on this subject of work. And we ask ourselves the question, why? Why does he do that? Why does he spend 8 verses looking at this expansive vista of existence only to ask, what do workers gain from their toil? Well, I think this question really just sums up the point of what Solomon has just said. What do workers gain from their toil? Well, the implied answer is nothing. Ultimately, when you look at life with a broad lens, a wide-angled lens, what do workers gain for their toil? Despite all the workers' hard work, ultimately, he or she has nothing to show for it. Because any money that he or she does earn, well, they have to spend it, and any money that they manage to save will ultimately be passed on to somebody else when they're no longer here. So Solomon is saying, what does the worker gain from their toil from an eternal perspective? Well, actually, nothing. Now, he's not saying that work isn't good and right and necessary, but he's just saying, ultimately, the worker doesn't get anything for their toil. And that's what he's been saying right throughout this passage. That is true of everything in life. Despite all of the positives, in a sense, nothing is gained from them. Because eventually they're cancelled out by the negatives, aren't they? Despite all the gains of life, they never seem to last because they're nullified by the losses. And so we live. That's positive. But then we die. We plant, but then we have to uproot. We laugh, but then we're made to cry. And so we never seem to get anywhere. We're always going back to the start. We're always starting again from scratch, it feels. Life, I don't know if you've ever been stuck in a set of revolving doors. You know, you go in and you're trying to get out, but you can't find the right opportunity with other people coming in and going out. And sometimes life feels like that, doesn't it? It's getting stuck in a set of revolving doors. You think you're about to enter into some happiness, but before you even blink, you're headed back to the hard times that you've just come from. Weddings are followed by funerals, health by sickness, peace by war, love by hate. And it's frustrating, isn't it? As soon as we think we've got a handle on life, something happens and we lose control of it. When we think we've got life all figured out, we get flanked by some unexpected catastrophe. Now, if you were in charge, what would life look like? If you were in charge of your life, if you could dictate the path that it went on, what would it look like? Maybe life would look a little bit like this. Maybe an ever-increasingly peaceful voyage up a gently flowing canal or stream, complete maybe with an onboard butler to serve us strawberries and cream and maybe a string quartet to soothe us to sleep. Maybe that's what your life would look like if you were in charge. Maybe that's not your cup of tea. Maybe you want something a bit more adventurous and active. But you get the idea, don't you? If we were in charge of our lives, we would make them as pleasant and pleasurable as possible. Or maybe if we could plot a graph, and I don't know if I'll get it the right way round because you're facing me. If we could plot a graph with time going along the bottom and happiness going the other way, we'd want it to go like that. Or like that, depending on what way you're looking. You just want it to increase. Your life just to be more and more pleasant for you to experience more and more happiness. But we're not in charge, are we? And so life doesn't look like that. And so I think that's why Solomon says what he says there in verse 10. I have seen the burden God has laid on the human race. He has made everything beautiful in its time. In other words, Solomon is saying, the one who makes everything right is not us. The one who makes everything right, the one who shines the light at the end of the tunnel is not us. The one who fixes our lives, it's not us, it's God. And that is burdensome to us because we want to be the ones to put everything right. We want to be the ones who fix all of our problems. We want to be the one who solves all of life's mysteries. And when do we want to do it? We want to do it now, don't we? We don't want to have to wait. We don't have to wait on God who makes everything beautiful in His time. We want Him to make everything beautiful in our time. And so we get frustrated. Maybe this morning you are frustrated with God. You're going through a situation which is making you say, God, what is going on? Why is this happening to me? Maybe life has not turned out the way that you wanted it to, and so you're annoyed at God. And again, it all comes down to control, doesn't it? If you're annoyed with Him, it's probably because you're experiencing something that is out of your control. You're annoyed because you're not in charge of the universe. If you were, you'd just step in and sort out all of the mess right away. But because you're not, God is the one who gets the brunt of your frustration. After all, you think, well, He's the one in charge, and yet He's not doing anything about it. And it's fine, isn't it, this morning for the atheist. It's fine for the person who doesn't believe in God. I read a quote last week from Richard Dawkins, and he said the universe is basically one that is marked and characterized by pitiless indifference. Everything is just random. Everything is just about the impulses that we have through evolution and atoms and molecules and all of these things randomly reacting and coming together. And so there's no one to blame. No one to blame for the hardships of life. No one to blame for the difficult things that we go through. The atheists, they don't have to blame God. They don't have to turn to anyone and say, this is all your fault, because to them everything is just random. There's no plan. There is no divine will to ascribe fault to. But we know, as verse 11 says, Solomon says there in verse 11, God has also set eternity in the human hearts. Yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. What's Solomon saying? We know enough because of God's grace, because we're made in the image of God. We know enough to know that there is more than the here and now. We know there's a God. We know there's a realm that we cannot see. But frustratingly, we don't know enough to know what God's plan is. We know enough to know that there is a plan, but we don't know enough to know what that plan is in all of its scale. We can't fathom what God is doing in our lives fully at any one time and how our situations will work out. Again, I think that's why Solomon says what he does in verse 12. He says, I know that there is nothing better for people than to be happy and to do good while they live. That each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil. This is the gift of God. Solomon's saying this. Don't worry about the big things. Don't worry about the big picture of what God is doing in your life. He says, leave those things to God. You focus on what is right in front of you. You worry about eating and drinking and working and finding satisfaction in these gifts that God has given to you. But do we take Solomon's advice? Often we don't, do we? We want to know what's going on? Why is this happening? And we want answers to the mysteries of life, and we want those answers now. There's a wonderful quote from one commentator, Derek Kidner. He puts it like this. He says, we are like the desperately nearsighted, inching their way along some great tapestry or fresco in an attempt to take it in. We see enough to recognize something of its quality, but the grand design escapes us. For we can never stand back far enough to view it as its creator does, whole and entire from the beginning to the end. We know God is weaving this great tapestry in our lives if we belong to Him. And we can see it up close, and it doesn't really make sense because it's all muddled. And we want to be those who can see all of it. And so we're trying to feel our way along this great tapestry, this fresco of life, trying to desperately work out what it's going to look like when we step back. But only God knows the big picture. Only God knows the beautiful image that He is weaving through our lives. And because we can't see that now, don't we get frustrated? Don't we want to know, God, why? Why is this happening? Why is this happening now? Why did you allow me to go through this situation? So to recap what we've seen so far, seen in this fallen, broken world, we're not in control. We know that. We know that God is ultimately in control, and because of that, we can be left frustrated. But the question we now need to ask ourselves is, should that be so? Should the fact that God is in control and we are not, should it frustrate us? Should it aggravate us, as it sometimes can do? Well, the answer to that question comes at the end of a verse that we've already looked at, and it's really the key to understanding this passage. It's the key to understanding why God sets times and seasons in our lives. Verse 14, look there with me. Solomon says in verse 14, I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God's work is eternal. He is sovereign in all things. God does it. Why? So that people will fear Him. Why does God do what He does? Why does He control, in a sense, the details of our lives the way that He does? Well, it's so people will fear Him. It's so that people will stand in awe of Him and worship Him. It's so that people will bow before Him and say, you are God, I'm not. I'm not the one who is in control. You are, and you know what you're doing. And so instead of frustrating us, the fact that God is in control should humble us. It should cause us to contemplate our finitude and our ignorance and marvel at God's infinitude and absolute wisdom. Because as Solomon says, He makes everything beautiful in His time, whether we believe it or not. He knows what He's doing. He knows the beginning from the end. But it's not always easy, is it, to do that? Sometimes Maybe it feels like the time to weep will never end. Maybe it feels like that season of grief is going on forever. And maybe like Job, who experienced unimaginable suffering, maybe like him, you ask yourself, why did I not perish at birth and die as I came from the womb? Life in this fallen world can be that painful sometimes, can be that perplexing, that agonizing. It causes us to cry out, what is going on? But does that make it right to question God? The pain that we experience, the suffering that we go through, is that an excuse to accuse him of wrongdoing? Many, I'm sure, do that. Even those who are God's people, just like Job, they question and second guess his goodness. They doubt his wisdom in allowing such painful and perplexing things to happen to them. But what did God say to Job? So Job had basically said to God, why me? I haven't done anything wrong, so why am I suffering? This isn't fair. The problem must be with you and your justice and your goodness. Job questions God, and so God turns the tables on Job and says to him, brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand who marked off its dimensions. Surely you know. Come on, Job. God says, you really want to question me? Then let me first ask you some questions. With all of your knowledge of what's right and wrong, this really should be a cinch. And after having posed question after question to Job for two whole chapters, imagine being questioned by God in that kind of way. God says to him, well, the one who contends with the Almighty correct him. Are you going to put me in my place, Job? Are you going to tell me what's right and what's wrong? Are you going to tell me how I have erred? In other words, if you think I've made a mistake, Job, then now is your chance to say. But Job is dumbstruck, isn't he? He doesn't really know what to say. And so God asks him another two chapters worth of questions that Job can't answer. And after all of it, the only thing Job can say is this: I know that you can do all things. No purpose of yours can be thwarted. You ask, who is it that obscures my plans without knowledge? Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. Job never got answers, did he? But the answer that he did get was, God is God and he wasn't. And that's what we need to know, isn't it? As we go through these painful, perplexing times, to come to that realization, God is God and good and wise and sovereign. And so when we're faced with things that don't make sense to us, how should we respond? When we don't understand what God is doing in our lives, what should we do? Well, we should remember the memory verse. We should remember to trust in the Lord with a little bit of your heart, half of your heart, three quarters of your heart. Trust in the Lord with all of our hearts. Not depend on our own understanding, trying to work it all out for ourselves, but to trust in the Lord with all your heart. Don't depend on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will make your paths what? Make them straight. And so just like Job, we recognize, God, you're God. We confess, no, we don't know what you're doing, but we confess that you do know what you're doing, and we thank you for that. We thank you that even though we can't fathom or understand it, you have a plan. You are in control. You are working your purposes out. I remember there's a website that I came across called Subzin, and I discovered that there are 760 titles, that is, films or TV episodes, that include the question, do you trust me? Now, I'm pretty sure that no one actually asked that question in real life, at least not in the kind of airy, melodramatic way that they do in the movies. You know, they say, do you trust me? And they squint their eyes and they tilt their heads, and it's all very rom-com-esque. But maybe someone did say, ask you that question. Imagine that. Say they looked you in the eye with all seriousness and they said, do you trust me? Wonder what your answer to them would be. Well, it depends, doesn't it? It depends on who is asking you that question. It depends on whether they are trustworthy or not. It depends on whether they have the power to keep their word or not. And without a measure of confidence in their character, their trustworthiness, without a degree of assurance in their capabilities, in their power to keep their word, you wouldn't be able to say, yes, yes, I trust you. Can we trust God this morning? Do we have a God who we can trust? Well, this morning we have a God who has both of those things. We have a God with a loving character and awesome capabilities, don't we? We have a God who is not only trustworthy, but who is also has the power to keep his word. And as I was saying earlier, if we want to find the answers to the questions that the book of Ecclesiastes poses, we need to look elsewhere. And actually, the answer to the question of can we trust God, we need to find the answer to that question where ultimately? In the gospel itself. Because that's where we see most clearly that we can trust God. We see there a God, as he sends his Son into the world to die for our sin, we see a God who loves lost, broken, dying people and who has the power to do something for them. In the gospel, we see a God who is full of compassion for a fallen world, who has the clout to intervene in our plight. We see a God who uses his sovereignty for good to save and rescue and restore and redeem. And in the gospel, we see a God who enters into the confusion and chaos and pain and perplexity of this world in the person of the Lord Jesus Christ. He knows what it's like to live in this broken world. He knows what it is like to submit to the will of his Father, even when in a sense he couldn't see the end. There in the Garden of Gethsemane, if it's possible, please take this cup from me. But he said, not my will, but your will be done. Ultimately, he knew that his Father's will was best. And in the gospel, we see a God who uses his sovereignty to, in all things, good or bad, pleasant or painful, he uses his sovereignty to work for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. So, Christian, maybe you're struggling to worship God for the fact that he is in control this morning, for the fact that all the situations of your lives, that the wonderful ones, the woeful ones, the unbelievably fantastic, the unbearably frustrating, all of those things and everything in between are ultimately ordered by him. If not directly through his active ordination, directly saying this is what's going to come to pass, then indirectly through his divine permission. We see that in the book of Job, don't we? God didn't strike Job, but he allowed Satan, as Satan came and asked for his permission for Satan to do that. And so ultimately all that happens in our lives has been permitted either directly or indirectly by the will of God. And if you're frustrated, struggling with that, what do you need to see? You need to see a God who uses his sovereignty in your favor. That his control is not capricious and malicious, but is so compassionate and merciful, to know that his sovereignty is for you and not against you. Now that doesn't mean this morning, and we know this, don't we? That's what we were saying last week, that we're exempt from the ups and downs of life. We know that. It doesn't mean that we will never go through any hard times. But what it does mean is that behind all of the highs and the lows, the rough and the smooth seasons, there is a God who really loves you and wants the best for you. A God that you can trust, and ultimately a God that you can worship. Now often when preachers preach on a particular subject, God will first teach them, or as is often the case, will reteach them the truths that they're about to teach before they themselves teach those things to other people. That's been my experience as I've been preparing, and I feel that God is wanting to share certain truths with the congregation. He first says, well, you need to learn this first. You need to go through those specific situations where you can learn to put these things into practice. And that's certainly been the case for me this week, as I've encountered again and again those situations, and we know these, don't we, that strip you of that self-confidence and that sense of control, and that cause you to either crumble in dread and despondency or cause you to cry out in desperation and dependence on the Lord. And so this week, as I stared in disbelief at a dialogue box that told me my document had a defect and that there was nothing I could do about it, when I struggled to find house keys before we set off one day, and you know, you begin to think of all of the scenarios, maybe someone has taken them and they know where we live, and wondering whether we're going to have to use the spares to get another pair cut, and we've only just changed the lock because Colin broke it, no offence to you, Colin. All of these things go through your mind, or when I went to Sainsbury's to get petrol, but only to find that the petrol station was shut, when I considered our car's need for rear brake pads as I set off to take the funeral, and wondering, well, where's the money going to come from to cover that and other impending expenditures? Where's it all going to come from? What accounts are we going to have to shuffle around to make sure that we can cover those costs? In all of those things, as I lived in an unpredictable world, where things are out of our control, where things don't go as we plan them to, what did I have to do? I had to fight the temptation to simply feel afraid and frustrated. That's how we feel, isn't it, when these things happen. We either feel fearful, what's going to happen? Where's this going to lead? And we think of all the trajectories, we catastrophize, that's the official terminology. We think of the worst case scenario, or we just feel frustrated. And we just wonder why God has allowed this to happen. And so I had to fight the temptation to feel that way, frustrated and afraid. And I have to remember, again, in the words of one of the songs that we sang at Holiday Bible Club this year, every tickety-tock, every tick of the clock is what is ruled by the hand of God. Every second, every hour, in His wisdom and His power. I needed to remember that He works His perfect plan. Can we trust Him? Yes, absolutely we can. And so this morning, no matter what minor irritation or major tragedy strikes you, no matter how loudly circumstances scream, you are not in control and cause us to feel like our lives are out of our hands, we must remind ourselves that there is one who is in control, who holds the lives of all those who belong to Him in His hands, who we can trust with all of our hearts for every hardship and heartache, because no matter how bitter the pill of providence is that we are forced to swallow, behind it is the smiling face of our Heavenly Father who loves us and works for our good through every sunshine and every storm and every season and every circumstance. We can trust Him and we can say, "You're God. You know what you're doing. You make everything beautiful in its time." And lastly, just as we close, we know, don't we, that we won't understand all that this life is about. We won't understand all of the plans and purposes of God, what He's doing in our lives until the end of the journey. Until we stand there in eternity looking back on all of the ups and downs, the sunshine and the storms of our lives, and we will go, "Yes, now we understand. Now we see the fresco in all of its beauty and majesty. Now we understand the tapestry that God was weaving. Now we see it from His vantage point." So this morning, trust Him. Worship Him. Don't give in to fear. Don't give in to frustration. But trust in the Lord with all your hearts. In all of your ways, remember Him, and He will make your path straight.